Oh, God.
Of what?
You didn't... Okay.
What?
I don't see a ukulele in your hands.
Oh, I haven't learned it yet, Larry.
I challenged you.
God damn it. Give me more than a day.
It's been three.
Larry wants me to learn this on ukulele so I can take it on the road. We're going to take the show on the road. Maybe we can do the Orange County Fair.
You know what?
One day.
A live Your Artificial Friends episode must happen.
There will
some
be
point.
No one there.
No.
Absolutely
you'll
no
have a crowd.
Okay, well, I have to stop this and ask.
If we can get you there, we could get a crowd.
Well, yeah, totally.
Has the podcast begun?
Yeah, kind of.
But there's a theme song that you guys are keeping me from playing.
I didn't even know the show had begun. There's no intro or anything?
You're already on restriction.
Okay.
Yeah.
I apologize.
Honestly, Mark, the whole point of me trying to do this preamble is to keep him from playing.
When the people that you know don't like you and your treasured friendships end, tune into this podcast. We're your artificial friends. Even did that in front of Rick Springfield in here. So,
oh, wow.
And taught him the song.
Oh, yeah. He was actually singing along there. Singing along. It was nice.
By the way.
Wait a minute.
He's a little pitchy.
Rick Springfield you had in here?
In this chair.
In that
How
chair.
Did you get him in here?
I don't know.
We're still figuring that. And by the way, had no problem coming. Look around this place,
Mark. Oh, sure. Oh, I know.
Yeah. He had no problem coming.
Oh, yeah.
He had just come from Corolla's place, which is apparently a lavish,
it's
beautiful.
Quite the studio.
Yeah.
I think he liked my green room better, which is the table and chairs out front here.
The carport.
With some Kirkland water and some sugar.
And some Eaton Park cookies.
You're letting me do nothing in order.
It's a podcast. Welcome. They already read the description. They know who's here. Go ahead. Do what you got to do.
I didn't think about that. That's time loopy. Something I haven't written
you don't
yet.
Have
They've
to read. You don't have to reset anything. You don't have to.
Mark Thompson's here is Yay! What I want to say, Larry. Good to have you here, buddy.
Good to be here. Thank you for inviting. In fact, such an idiot, I wondered, should I text Andy and see if there's talking points? Apparently, there's none. They were just going to sit here and yammer.
This is the complete polar opposite of how Mark prepares for a podcast. Because
oh, yeah.
I've seen him prepare for a radio show. He does it the same way.
Yeah.
He starts the day before. It's the 24-hour show prep when you do a morning show that has content. And you always have a piece
good,
of paper.
If you're good. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And even some who aren't.
Yeah.
But you always, if you watch something on TV, see something, you'll jot it down so you don't forget it, so you remember to bring it up. Mm-hmm. And then the night before, you'll probably do preliminary stuff where you go through the wire, the different websites and a prep site and pull out any stories that you want to talk about the next day. And then and you can also get music ready for it,
God,
and all that kind of stuff.
Exhausted and hearing you talk about it.
The next morning, you'll wake up, and well, of course, he was on the East Coast when we were doing it together. So,
yeah.
He woke up at a reasonable time, like 6 a.m. or whatever.
I did,
and did all this stuff, and didn't start the show until 9 his
right.
time. And then you'll do show prep right up until the time the show begins, mm-hmm. and then you go. This is totally the seat of our pants.
Ugh. It's driving me nuts.
See, no,
it's
terrifying.
This is terrifying.
This should be liberating to you. This is what was so liberating to me when I started. By the way, Larry Morgan here. There's Andy Chanley.
Oh, and Josh Fligger and Sam Farmer on assignment.
I was so liberated by podcasting because it was the antithesis of all that. I could take.
Have a ghosting reflex where I reach for content that I prepared. This is hard for me.
Is it?
However, this is your podcast. And I'm here to help. Lend a hand.
I appreciate this. No, it's great to have you here. And pull back the curtain. We just had lunch a little bit ago, which my money is no good.
Oh.
My money is no good at the front yard.
All right, Larry, down the street. Let me ask you a question. Yeah,
sure. By the way, when you said we just had lunch, I was not invited. No, I just want to make that clear.
Specifically, we're not.
No, I know.
So the bill comes, and Andy does that ridiculous reach for his wallet.
Is he patting pockets? And
He made a really, really sad attempt at getting his credit card.
No, I've seen his acting.
But what kind of person would I be Because here I am. I'm retired. I'm good to go. Yeah. I'm having lunch with this guy who has no job. And by the way, no hope of a job. And so I'm going to have him pay half? No. I wouldn't be able to sleep at night.
You know what? That is absolutely unfair. I totally hope for a job.
Yeah. He does have a podcast.
Yes. So. And making no money just like me.
I hope you made him leave the tip at least.
And then we ride home. This is great. I drive the worst beater ever. I got it because it was a cheap commuter car.
You know, but you've always been very frugal when it comes to it. You don't drive flashy cars. That's not your thing.
I used to have a BMW when I didn't have
kids. Okay, there was that time.
Yeah. But so I drive this shitty Ford Fiesta that I leave the keys in everywhere I go, praying.
Someone please take it.
Yeah.
Praying someone takes it.
Nope.
But we go there, and Mark has a German sports car. And he's giving me the sob story of, hey, but you know, my car's just not working right. It's something wonky with it. Can you keep your eye out? I'm just going to follow you over to your house. Let me know. So I'm driving down the road, actually worried more for his German engineered sports car and that it's going to make the trip versus my Fred Flintstone powered piece of crap. Yeah. You don't know that the problem's fixed. I'll trade you straight up right now.
I appreciate the offer. I really do. I seriously do. But that is a shit car you're driving. I mean, it. Don't get me wrong. It's a chick magnet. I saw women in cars looking at you go, ooh, he's driving a Ford.
He doesn't care.
Well, you know, Fiesta does mean party.
Yes. So. Yes, it does. I saw that.
Mm-hmm.
Ford Fiesta. I didn't realize they still made those.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they brought it back. for me.
They refined it.
Todd Donahoe say his favorite beer was cheap and on sale. We were talking about that last week. My favorite car is one that's paid off.
Oh, yeah, that is kind
not
of
not having a car
thing.
Payment is nice.
Remember the first time you did that? Ever like paid your car off? Wasn't that just the most amazing thing to write that last check?
You know, I have to tell you because this you mentioned paid off. This was such a surprise to me. I had my home in California,
right.
Santa Clarita. And we were about to buy the house that we now live in North Carolina. And so I'm on the phone with my attorney, and I'm going, can I swing this? I mean, we're going to eventually sell California, but in the meantime, can we swing this? And he goes, I thought I told you, like a year ago, you paid off your California house.
Oh, you didn't know.
Oh, God.
Okay, no, I didn't. And I got to tell you, the feeling, because I was basically realizing, no matter what happens, they can't take my house. I own this.
Right.
I'm in. This is – I really can't overreact to the great feeling that was to know that I own that. It was mine.
Yeah. That's got to be amazing. I mean, I remember – this is so weird to say. There was an All in the Family episode. You were too young for this show. Archie Bunker, Edith.
Yeah.
Okay. There's a whole episode where they – pay off their mortgage, that little house they live in New York,
they
or
burn
Queens,
the,
or whatever.
They burn the receipt.
Yeah, and it was. I remember thinking at the time, it's like I was so young, but it was like that is a concept that must mean something to people in America that they actually pay off their house.
That
and
I think
I realized,
means less now. I don't think as many people realize that in their lifetimes.
Oh, considering I'm going to be well into my 80s by the time I get to do that. Yeah, if ever.
Well, I got to also tell you, we're getting ready to sell the California house. I spent a year getting it ready, paint, landscaping, all that stuff. And so I'd hired a realtor, and he goes, okay, so Mark, based on the market, in my experience, it's going to take about 9 months to sell the house.
Right.
And so we decide to list it because I was leaving Mark and Brian in August and I would be in North Carolina by September. So we list it mid-January, prepared for the 9 months. The very first day, the house sold.
Wow.
Sold for the asking price. He didn't dicker. And then...
He didn't what?
See, Andy's...
Did we warn you about the language?
He's entertained by the fact that I said dicker.
Yeah, I know.
We don't have any prepared content.
No, we don't. I keep reaching for it.
No low-hanging fruit.
You'll notice he hasn't matured much since you left.
No. Well, The point is, the house sold. We had to then go live in a hotel for 8 months. Based on that, what that guy told me.
Right.
It's going to take until September. No, it didn't. Yeah. Day one.
Oh, yeah. God. Well, when we bought this house, I got a realtor and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Everybody told me that was important to do. And, right, you know, sure. Have somebody show me some houses. I find this house the first day I'm looking on Zillow, and I turn, I'm like, hey, you know, maybe we should go look at that one. Come in here. It's the first house we looked at. Put an offer in it. The offer immediately accepted, and we're in the stuff like that. Never happens. Yeah. I guess now inventory is dear, and that happens quicker and quicker. But this place, welcome to Shea Chanley, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah. This looked like a minimum security prison when we first moved in here. It was a hellhole, and it had bars. You know, the iron bars up on all of the windows. There were security doors, those big, you know, steel security doors you can't see through on all of the doors. Jeez. And so forth.
Yeah. Well, wait, what about that makes you think you want to live in the neighborhood that has a house
well,
like
here's
that?
The thing. I think we spoke about this before, but I asked the next door neighbors. She was getting that house ready to sell for her mother, and she had lived here her entire life. I said, let me guess. This neighborhood was a lovely neighborhood when these houses were built in the 40s, mm-hmm. on up through the late 60s, mm-hmm. when the neighborhood turned a little dicey, mm-hmm. and bars went up, and now the neighborhood's coming back because the North Hollywood Arts District is moving this way, and these people were just the last to take off their bars. And she said, no. Nobody around here had. Only this woman who lived here, because I guess she had gotten attacked in a previous home somewhere, and on the Whittier or somewhere, and she moved over here, got an alarm, got dogs, got, you know, the security doors, and put bars up on everything, put a fence around with a gate and all that kind of stuff, because she was, you know, terrified. As, and you could totally understand that. But I came in, found a junk man for the weight of the steel. The first week I was here, I'm like, take those off. And he took them. It was those security screws that are 5 inches long.
Sure.
So he was there with the vice grips, one turn at a time, on 15 windows, four times. Poor son of a bitch. But he got like 300 pounds of steel and hauled it off. And instantly, the house was still piss yellow. But instantly, people were thanking us on the street. People were like, thank you for making the lights work on your fence again. Thank you for it's interesting how, you know, in a neighborhood like this where that wave of gentrification, of renewal is coming out from North Hollywood as all of these apartments go up now around here. Like, you know, if you are on Magnolia, whatever, they're putting up all of these, you know, 100-unit complexes.
Yeah, a row
and now,
yeah.
Now they're mixed use.
Right.
We're on the bottom.
Retail on the bottom.
Retail, good restaurants.
Trendy coffee shops.
Coffee shops and grocery stores and so forth. And then up above, you have the apartments. And that makes living in the neighborhoods near that so much better. And down the way, down by the 170, the Macy's, mm-hmm. and the, what was that? Was it North Hollywood Mall?
Yeah.
In 1994, the Northridge earthquake, every building fell apart except for that one Macy's. That's why when you drove by, there's like, why is there one Macy's in a huge parking lot?
And nothing else.
That was the only thing left standing. Now they're turning that into a Grove kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, Grove or what's the one in the Americana in Glendale? So this whole neighborhood is coming back around. Why did you live in Santa Clarita, up in Valencia area. Why did you choose to live there versus, because you had gambling money.
Oh, yeah.
And you were down, what was it, La Cienega and whatever
Rodeo.
That is. I mean, that's a drive.
It's a good point.
You could have lived in the other end of Rodeo Drive, mm-hmm. and just driven 5 minutes to work.
Well, I was doing a podcast a couple of weeks ago, and the question from the host was, do you have any regrets as far as, you know, career? And I said, yeah. The fact that I bought a house 40 miles from where I work. So I was chewing up nearly 100 miles a day getting to work, and that was my only regret. Then he said, well, no, I mean about the show. I said, no, my entire career, I have no regrets about that. The genius that is me, I wanted my kids who were young to have plenty of room to run and play. So in the neighborhood that I bought in, each lot is 2 acres.
Right.
So tons of yard, and that was the reason for the purchase. And then once we lived there, computers were all the rage, and my kids never left their fucking room. Yeah, honestly, if I had to do it again, it would be Beverly Hills. I would have been 3 miles from the station,
right,
and it would have been awesome.
How shocked were you when you were driving in that early, and in L.A. there were already so many freaking people on the road?
Yeah, it's nuts.
Because I made the same drive to the Sound for years,
right,
and at 4 or whatever in the morning, I'm going, all of these people can't have morning shows.
Right.
Where the fuck are they going?
Yeah, well, some of them are just coming home, and that's the scary part.
Yeah, that's true.
I remember having that thought, because I would leave the house at 4:30, and they're, you know, all 6 lanes of the 405 were packed. I mean, we were moving at 60.
Right.
But
there's still a lot of cars.
No question.
Yeah, it was weird.
Speaking of that, I want to talk a little bit about radio.
Okay.
And I'm not saying this to blow smoke, but I love K-Earth.
Oh, thanks.
The majority of my...
I just took credit for that.
Oh, thank you.
Well,
hey, thank you, Mark.
I'm really proud. That's,
yeah, Larry, I came up with the name.
Larry is the assistant PD to his nights. So the majority of my career was spent in top 40 radio.
Yeah.
So the stuff that you're playing is right up my alley.
Oh, it's what I was playing when I was in top 40.
Right.
So it's weird. Also, you know, I don't know how much more I can listen to AHA take on me, but...
Yeah, well, see...
But still.
Yeah, you're still on the air. I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm just in the car a little bit, and I really enjoy what you're doing. So while we're talking about that, my next question is, and of course, I flip whenever we're in town, I always, you know, punch the channels. What is KLOS playing? I have punched in, and I shit you not, the 4 or 5 times I punched in, I did not know I had never heard the song. What is there a name for it? Is it a format? What is it?
It's Southern California's best rock.
Best rock. It's best rock.
It's Southern California's most unknown rock.
Now you would think when the Sound went away that they would go, oh, easy peasy, we play the hits,
right,
because we're the best game in town, only game in town for classic rock or whatever.
Right.
And you're right. I mean, I don't really punch over to them.
I understand what you're saying. You know, you take your finger out of a glass of water, see how quickly it fills up. You know, you leave the market, you would think that somebody would come. But I've had this for a while. I have a theory that there is a secular shift in people's taste, that a lot of the standards of classic rock, you know, Purple Haze and Light My Fire, that people have heard these particular songs so much that they're no longer novel to them and no longer a release. And the thing that K-Earth did is K-Earth was, you know, when I first moved to L.A. in 97, K-Earth was playing 60s songs.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. When I first got here, it was 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. I didn't move here in the 50s.
They were currents.
I just want to make that. God damn it.
So, and then over time, you stop playing 60s music,
right,
by and large.
It's gone.
There's no 60s
no
music.
60s, no.
No Beatles.
No,
no old Rolling Stones,
nope,
and stuff like that.
Nope.
And you're playing songs from the 90s?
Yep.
Yeah, it's edging into the 90s, yes.
So what you've done is slowly grow old with your
audience.
So every year you kind of move a year up and continue to keep pace with your audience. The Sound, for example, by contrast, was, you know, tighter and tighter playing, and that's the format.
Mm-hmm.
They were playing classic rock songs.
Right.
And with the way ratings are figured now, people, when they punch in, they've discovered that, you know, with these meters, it has to be something familiar, or they're distracted by the kids in the back seat, or somebody cutting them off, or whatever. They don't want to hear, Miles Davis, Bitches Brew. They want to hear something that's not
right,
angular and crazy. So I wonder if classic rock in general, and I haven't seen this borne out in ratings across the country, and frankly, don't give enough of a shit to have a look.
I hear you.
But I wonder if people have just moved on from it, and in order to get younger listeners, that's what you have to do.
I know that's what we've done, because I think we had to to survive. Yeah, I think just the whole genre of classic rock is gonna, part of the reason. I mean, it's amazing the sound lasted as long as it did, because to only have to have two stations in that format in a market this size, that it's basically pulling from the same pool of music. You would think that KLOS would be doing okay if they were just playing those tracks, but that it would skew much older, which it does. It's very hard to go any further into the eras of classic rock, because then what becomes classic rock at that point? And the reason we've managed to have success with it is that we found that there was a passion for especially that sweet spot in the 80s,
right,
that wasn't getting play. I mean, 3 years ago when I showed up, they had just made that transition. K-Earth was way behind, and they were really actually holding on way too long to that 60s and 70s thing.
I mean, like yesterday, you played Sweet Dreams Are Made of This, Eurythmics.
Oh, yeah.
I was a jock at that time, so I'm the sweet spot with your station. I love it.
Yeah, and it's working. I mean, it's that is... That is what, but basically KRS philosophy has been we're the station that's going to play songs that are 20, 30, 40 years old. The best of the best from those eras. And if you do the math, that's where, and 90s, by the way, that's 20, that's where we're into 20 years ago.
And you know, most of you aren't in radio, never have been in radio. You would be shocked if you knew the amount of research that goes into the songs that are chosen. It's not just random. They didn't throw open a billboard and go, let's just play these 40. Research. They put people in a room, and they will sample. And I'll just give you an example. People are sitting in chairs. These are random people in the demo, the demographic of the people that listen to the radio station. And in some cases, not all the research is like this, but they're holding on to a round knob, the audience. So that...
Do they dicker with the knob?
I'm with five.
By the way, you found the theme of the podcast, by the way, is giggle at everything that sounds remotely dirty.
So these people are holding on to a wheel.
Yes.
And they play the sweet spot of a song that they want to research.
Like 7 seconds of it.
Yeah. And the person sitting with their hand on the wheel, if they like it, they turn it to the right. If they don't like it, they turn it to the left. And then they put together all that information, all that data, and the songs that a radio station plays is built around that information. And they do it, how many? Oh, God.
Why?
Turning the knob to the left, I hate this song.
And by the way, so do most of our listeners. They don't like this one either.
Oh, God.
So that's an auditorium test. There you would have turned your knob to the left.
I would have.
And that one would
Does
have sunk.
Does he know that that is in particular a red flag song for you?
Yes.
It's like a PTSD song.
On my last day at the sound, this was Dave who programmed it, but as I said goodbye and they went to music, it was Crocodile Rock Elton John.
Now, it's one slight difference in what you're talking about is because of the advent of the internet, in order to, and this is depends on the research company, but in order to have a greater pool of people to choose from, they have made it available to people in their home. And you go down the line and you click on these hooks, as we call them, the few seconds of a song, and you rate it. And that way you actually get a much, you know, larger database to deal with. So you hope that the numbers are a little more accurate. And you usually pull it from, you know, a pool of people who say your station is their favorite. And then maybe you go to a pool of people who have your station as your second favorite, just to get, and then you break it all down by male, female, and
but regardless,
race, and all
it's
that sort of
all people who need $50 and some free Papa John's pizza.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They don't go in there because they like you.
No. I'm not sure they're getting $50.
Which
they might get the pizza.
By the way, speaking of Elton John, we saw him at the Greek. And it was my only time to
tantrum?
Witness. Yeah, his.
He does it all the time. He just threw another one the other day.
That was what I was going to say.
You know why?
Why?
Because he invites people up on stage for Saturday Night's All Right for fighting. And he does it. And some guy's over there trying to high-five him. He's like, hey, high-five. To try to get a high-five from Elton John. And he gets pissed and stops and walks off. He goes, you fucked it up. No more coming on stage for Saturday night.
God. Well, my night, it was because the piano, he started the song. And he got about 30 seconds in, and he takes his hands and slams it on the keys, and he walks off. So then techs come out. They're working on the piano. Finally, he comes back. He plays 20 seconds, slams the keys, and stomps off again. This went on five times, and he goes into the song finally, and he's singing it, and he's finally doing it, but then he gets the urge, "It's still not fucking right," yells backstage. That was the fit we got. Now, now, you may think that that was a terrible show. This is 20 years ago, and I'm still talking about it. I got to see one of the greats throw a hissy fit like you've never seen. I saw, I witnessed it.
Yeah. That's great.
He's been doing that his whole career. There was a show I did in the 90s with Seacrest. What was that thing we did at Premiere? Live from the Lounge. Basically kind of took the Star Lounge thing we were doing at Starnet 8.7 and made it a syndicated show. Elton John was a guest. So it was a small setting. It was in a studio. Ryan, Elton, electric piano. And there couldn't have been more wrong with that rented electric piano. God. He had asked for a Baby Grand. Couldn't exactly fit it through the door of the studio. We didn't have it available. So that was like the third option on the list was this very specific brand and model of electric piano. Hated it. The one he asked for, but it was all wrong. And it just took, you saw Ryan use every ounce of what charm he had that day to win him over. And it turned out all right. But man, it was just like, is he going to walk? We had a live show that was going.
It would have been great.
Yeah, it would have been fantastic.
We would still be talking about it.
I'm still talking about it because it was that close to me just going, I don't know how we're going to fill. I guess I'm going to run in and start doing impressions. I had no idea what we were going to do.
All right, since we're still dancing on radio, I'm going to share a light bulb moment for me. I knew that I wanted to be a major market jock. My first job in my hometown, there was a box of tapes in the production room, and I listened to them, and they were air checks of major market 10Q, WABC, KHJ. And I would listen to these tapes, and they sounded so good. Not like that dumpster fire I was working at. this sounded, and I made the decision. I want to be a major market jock. Right. So I knew.
You were in Birmingham?
No, Muscle Shoals.
Muscle Shoals.
In my hometown.
Okay.
And I knew that if I was going to have a shot at getting to the major market, I was going to have to leave home and start working my way up the ladder. And a 16-year-old made this decision that every job I took would be in a larger market and for more money. Because eventually, you're going to step off the edge and you're in major market. That was the plan.
Sure.
All right, so the first job was Enterprise, Alabama, little bitty, even smaller than Muscle Shoals. But it was the only job I could find that got me out of my hometown.
Right.
Second job was Knoxville, Tennessee, WRJZ, a white hot AM radio station. Every shift was high profile, high personality. The program director, Bob Kagan, a genius at programming. However, you put him in a social setting, he couldn't speak. He couldn't. He was so... Okay. So I was the music director, and I did 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. And
good gig.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Hey.
In Knoxville.
Yeah,
Knoxville. You're on your way, buddy.
You take what you get.
I'm working around all these great personalities. When I would get off at 6, the number one morning show was CP and Walker. And I would hang around.
CP?
CP.
Okay, good.
And Walker. And I would hang around, go get them biscuits and eggs, and they would periodically put me on the radio as the traffic guy or do something crazy, whatever. So I got my first experience behind the scenes of a really hot show. All right. So on the weekend, I did Saturday afternoon.
Oh, cool. Right.
Now, again, I mentioned Kagan. So at this point, Star Wars is out.
The original.
The original Star Wars is out. And so I cued the mic, and I said, 62 WRJZ, the Star Wars, the film, you're either going to it or coming from it. And I've got this squeaky control room chair. I'm going to perform for you the entire soundtrack of Star Wars on this chair. And so I squeaked around for 20 seconds and hit the spot. Door opens.
Wow.
It's Kagan. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what have I done? He simply said, in the future, every time you cue the mic, I want something as creative and good as that. And he left. So I'm driving home, and I'm trying to, I said, wait a minute. The squeaky chair is the kind of shit that I would do for my friends at the apartment right. after a lot of pot just to get a giggle. He's telling me to be myself on the radio.
Yeah.
And it honestly was. It was the beginning of what became me.
Yeah. I do. I love that story because I have. I think if at any point in this industry or any other that you have somebody who basically enables you mm-hmm. to have that freedom right. as opposed to trying to kind of clamp you down. And I had the same situation. I think all three of us had probably very similar situations. We all started in small towns. Mm-hmm. We were trying to emulate something bigger than what we had where we were. I was in Odessa, Texas, mm-hmm. and I was always hearing tapes from. For me, it was KFI, WLS, all these guys that sure. I had heard about, and guys there trying to emulate those big boss type jocks, big personalities, having too much fun.
Drake Chanel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I get on the air at KOZA in Odessa, Texas. I finally start to get my doing my shifts, and I can't believe the balls I had at this time. But my first shift, I had gone into the production room and created an opening for myself. I had learned how to edit, you know, razor blades and tape and the whole bit. And I had sound effects and comedy records. I was a comedy nerd. I had Steve Martin records, all that stuff. I cut together pieces of, you know, there was an explosion and then it was, you know, him going, and now for something, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it was, and then it went into Cars by Gary Numan. That was the first song I ever played. And my program director at the station, Gary Winter, if you're out there, kind of came in and said, yeah, maybe don't like create your own opening. You know, that's not. So I was like, okay. So a couple of months in, I'm at a record store at the Wynwood Mall in Odessa, Texas, and I see who I know is the program director for KRIG, the competitor station, the top 40 in town. And he's playing it cool. And but he comes over, he talks to me and says, I was driving back in, and I heard you on the weekend. I was only doing weekends at the time. And he said, I heard you say something about it's National Socks Day, so everybody take your socks off and throw them at the radio. It was some ridiculous bit I did. And he said, and I finally said to myself, KOZA finally has a creative jock. And for me, it was a competitor, mm-hmm, PD, mm-hmm. who, by the way, I ended up working for. Mm-hmm. And I'm still friends with. He's my son's godfather. I mean, he was the guy that said, it's okay to be that idiot, and he'd rather me be that than have to kick me in the ass to be something creative. Right. And that's that. You're right. That is a – I mean, did you must have had yeah. somebody like that, right?
I had an angry, angry program director the first place I went to work. I was doing news, part-time news, which is another story altogether. But I went from the newspaper at Purdue. I was managing editor of the, you know, this 20,000 daily circulation paper. Lots of responsibilities and you know, lots of rules. And end up doing radio news, going out to, you know, these ribbon cuttings and ditch diggings and board meetings and, you know, asking people stupid questions. And I remember I was filling in for the news director one morning, and I was in there doing the news. It was like first time I was doing it. And I was nervous and trying to, you know, just get everything done and do it right and be professional and not screw up anything I read. And program director comes in. This big guy, 6'5" or something, comes in, throws open the door of the studio and says, "Are you having fun?"
Ooh, good God.
I said, "What? Are you having fun on the radio?" I'm like, "Yeah." I said, "Well, then act like it."
Wow.
I'm like, "What's going on?" And for a couple of minutes, it threw me. I'm like, oh my God, what's, you know, I was apoplectic. I was scared. I was intimidated, but like, oh, am I ruining it? My first chance? And it wore off. The adrenaline, it's the shock of it. It wore off after a few minutes, and I started laughing. I'm like, you know what? No one's ever going to be able to do that to me again. Mm. No one's ever going to, because I realize that it's the more comfortable I get with it, the better I'll be. But I'm not going to let criticism get in the way of what I'm doing. And then that same PD asks us all. He hires a consultant, Alex Demers, I think, and he hires this consulting company. He says, "Everybody, give me a tape." but tape one of your recent shows. So I go back and I check out and I think about it. I give him the worst tape of the previous week, the one that I thought I fucked up the most stuff on. And I send that one. And I wondered for a while why I did that, but I don't know if it was self-sabotage because I didn't want to move forward, or if it was, well, if that one's good enough, then I know the other ones are too. Mm-hmm. But I send it off, and he comes back, and I've told you about this before, I think, Larry, and maybe you, Mark. It was the biggest compliment I ever got. Mm. He said, Andy doesn't sound like a DJ. He sounds like somebody that you want to go have a beer with after he's done and talk about the music.
That is a unique ability.
And that is... And I, you know, somebody might hear that and take it as an insult, like, well, shit, I wanted to be Wolfman Jack. Mm-hmm. But it was a huge compliment to me because it said to him that he heard some authenticity. Mm-hmm. You know, a hillbilly, for sure, but something authentic. And so I remember then going down to Indianapolis. I get the overnight job mm-hmm. at an alternative station in Indianapolis in 1994. I'm doing the overnights. The morning show is going to move to the sister station, so the mornings are going to be open. The mornings had been open, and I wanted them. I'd only been there a few months, but, you know, I wanted to do that. I wanted to, you know, I thought I could do, a shocky, jockey, alternative morning show. He's interviewing people. While I'm around, you know, for this job, people are coming in from everywhere. One of the guys, I think he still works in town. I think he worked over at Sirius. Will Pendarvis. He had a great show down in, I want to say, Atlanta. And I heard like one of the bits that he did. It was you know, genuinely funny. He played the public affairs sounder music, you know, like from old TV, from 70s TV. Do 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 do. He goes, "This is Health Check with Will Pendarvis." He's like, "Well, let me see. Yeah, I feel all right today. Yeah, I think I feel good. This has been Health Check." I'm like, "That's original. That's fun. This guy's going to be good, and he's going to get this job." So I get wind that the program director is doing his weekly new music show at a local bar in Broad Ripple on Saturday night. So I'm going to fucking be there. This is what's going to happen. I go down there, and while he's – and sure enough, he had invited this guy out to, you know, have some beers and chat and whatever. While he's talking to somebody else, he's away from the table. I'm across the table from Will and his fiance, I think, and he's like, "So what's Scott like to work with?" I said, "He's good. You know, he really – I've enjoyed it because I don't have a lot of experience. And I need somebody like him because he's one of those guys that's constantly coming in the studio and reminding me about the things that I've forgotten. And you know, that kind of stuff is helpful to me. People that, you know, check my work because I just don't, I'm afraid of making a mistake. And he's one of those guys that's really hands-on. Lots of meetings to make sure that we're all focused and that kind of stuff. Saying all this stuff that nobody wants to hear when they're doing that gig. And sure enough, he turns it down. and then, like a short time after that, like the next week, Offspring, they're white hot. They're what's that big album, the first one, that Smash, was it? You know, they had Keep 'Em Separated, right, and those big songs from the early 90s, 94. And they're brand new. They're on top of the alternative charts. They come in. They're going to come in. Well, before that, they call me. The afternoon guy calls me up and says, "Hey, I'm going to be out. Can you come and fill in?" This is like noon. He calls me. I had just gotten a wisdom tooth pulled, an impacted tooth, and I was on Vicodin.
Oh, geez.
And I remember taking the call and half asleep. I'm like, "Yeah, I'll be there." I get dropped off at the station. I proceed to do the evening show. This band comes in. It's announced to me when I get there that they're going to be taking over and doing, you know, taking calls and so forth. We had such fun and taking phone calls and, you know, playing new music from Rancid. They just got me Time Bomb. They brought in the cassette because it was brand new. Doing all this stuff, having a great time. They leave. The PD comes in, throws open the door, and I'm out to sea on Vicodin. And he throws open the door. He goes, "That was top-notch radio. That was great.
Great. I'm going to have to take Vicodin before every
yeah,
show.
Yeah, that's right. How enhanced do I need to be to have a good show?"
And I end up getting the morning show like a week or so later. And it was just a happenstance, but a little bit of subterfuge of torpedoing this other poor fucker.
You know, I can remember the moment that I decided I was going to go be on the radio. I found out, I'm 16. If I took my mother's car, yellow Volkswagen, 73.
Sweet.
If I took my mother's car, backed it out of the driveway, and parked it on the front lawn, I could turn on AM and I could pick up WLS in Chicago to listen to John Records Landecker. That really is my name. So one night he was doing Boogie Check. And those of you that have never heard Boogie Check, it really is people calling in. And he would go Boogie Check, and then they would say whatever they were going to say, and he'd move on to the next one, Boogie Check. That was all it was. All right, so I'm listening to it. So he goes, Boogie Check. And this guy goes, "Oh, John, I can't tell you what a fan I am. I can't even believe I'm on the air with you. I love you. I live only to listen to your show." Click, Boogie Check. That was the moment. And so I mean, that's so good. That's just so good. So that was it. I mean, I was on fire with being on the radio. So I went to the radio station that I grew up listening to, WOWL in Muscle Shoals. And I go and I say, "I'd like to be on the radio." And she goes, "Well, have you ever worked anywhere?" And I said, "No." And she goes, "Well, we can't put you on the air unless you have experience." And I'm, you know, chicken of the egg. So, okay, I leave. I go to every radio station, including WSHF, which was a daytimer country radio station. Daytimer meaning when the sun comes up, you turn it on. When the sun goes down, you turn it off. That's the daytime. The general manager's name, I still remember, Gary Wright. I wanted
the Dreamweaver.
Yeah. I wanted to be on the radio. And he said, "Well, listen, let's do this. I need a janitor." True story, every word of it. And he said, "So after school, you come over and you clean up, take out the trash, vacuum a little bit, wipe stuff down, and then you go into the control room because we're not on the air and you can practice. And I'll give you Sunday afternoons where you run the board because there's no music. We have the preachers come in." So that's my new job. So, and on Sunday, it's pretty funny. I was told strictly, when the preachers come in, they get 30 minutes for $27.50. One guy paid in quarters.
So you're having to do the right transaction?
$27.50. And he said, "Until they've given you the money, don't let them in the studio."
Oh, my God.
Which was next door to the control room. So they would come in, $27.50. One guy would come in with a friend. And they would pay their money, and the preacher's up there preaching, and his friend is standing in the corner, and every 8 seconds, "Hallelujah! Praise Jesus!" So, all right, so I'm getting experience on the board through that. Because I had
quit show business?
I had to play commercials. And by the way, this was so long ago that the commercials, we had two reel-to-reel machines, and the commercials were only, So... Okay.
So you were active. I mean, this was not just sitting back and watching a computer.
Busy. No, I wasn't playing music because of the preachers, but I had commercials I had to do.
You had stuff you had to do.
So I was busy. So in the meantime, during the week at night, I would come in, sit at the control room, hit record on the reel-to-reel, and I would record myself. I then edited that together into a 3-minute air check.
Awesome.
I took it back to WOWL, this is about 6 months later, I give my tape. They hired me to do weekends, midnight to 6, at the station I grew up listening to.
That's awesome.
And that first Friday night, it's like 11:55, and I'm about to do my first shift, and I realized, you've never actually ever been on the air. The first hour was rough.
Yeah.
Oh, God. But I got through it.
That's so great. I had... similar circumstance where it's funny because we were just having this conversation at the radio station about there's a girl who works there who is just out of college, and she's just one of those rare people who says that she's willing to, you know, learn everything, say yes to everything, you know, no matter what the job might be. She just wants the experience. And it's kind of rare now when you run into somebody who's willing to just kind of go for it and learn it and absorb it. And I think it's from, I don't know, I hate to sound like the grumpy old man going, kids just don't have the same work. But we did. We said yes to any crappy job that got us in the door. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was, I didn't have to be the janitor, but I had to go in and audition. I knew somebody at my high school who was dating one of the disc jockeys, because disc jockeys are horn dogs and are sometimes cruising high schools. Anyway, helped me get in the door. I did an audition reading news. He told me I was terrible, but they hired me to run. Everybody's had this job. Run Casey Kasem on the weekend.
Sure.
And they had a couple of they had Powerline. Remember Powerline?
I queued them up every Sunday morning.
Yeah, my first job that was not news was running the Superstar Concert Series and the King Biscuit Flower.
And then we had a local show called Soul Patrol, which was this little AM station in Odessa, Texas. Nod of the head to an ethnic community. And it was Gary McCollum, a guy who Chris McCoy still works in Houston, who came in, pre-taped a soul show that I ran off reel to reel. So
I want to go back to Casey Kasem.
Yeah.
When this
was on vinyl. Mine was on vinyl.
No, I was doing it when it was reel to reel.
Oh, man. Oh,
wow. Each hour was on a reel to reel. And you'd cue it up, and that was
it. Yeah. They finally started pressing it on vinyl.
Right.
And the cheapest possible vinyl.
Which, by the way, if you can actually find those on eBay or whatever, those are pretty valuable.
Really?
Because, the only copies went to radio stations. They weren't available to the public.
Right.
And they don't. I mean, after a couple of plays, they literally start to deteriorate. They're just the cheapest, wobbliest. I would actually take a couple out of the station, put them in my trunk, you know, I'll listen to them later, you know, have them as a keepsake. But in West Texas in the summertime, you open that up and suddenly it's an ashtray. It's just like a shrinky-dink American Top 40 ashtray. Sometimes we would take them out back because we were outside the city limits. You know, you had a tower, you know, with the light on top of it, the flashing light on top, and you just zing them across the vacant lot as like a frisbee. So one night I'm on the air. I am not the janitor, but the cleaning lady is in house that night. And at the time, there were a lot more commercial breaks. Casey would play like maybe two songs, and then they'd stop and do a short. So finally, there was a long segment. I'm looking at the cue sheet for how the show is going to lay out, and it's finally going to be like a 3 or 4 song set. And it's like, all right, I have time to take a shit. It's the one time in the 6 hours I'm stuck here, and I really got to go.
And let me interject. When you're in radio, you play the longest song you have, which at that time I think was 4 minutes and 45 seconds. Yeah. DJs learn to shit in four minutes and get back.
Yeah, that's why classic rock shocks.
You should never strain.
No,
that's right.
No.
That's right.
You got to wait until you.
That's why classic jock. Classic rock jocks always had the healthiest bowels because they had Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, you had Stranglehold and Low Spark of High Heel Boys. You were set.
So I ran to the restroom. I'm doing my business. I'm a youngster in West Texas, so I'm not exactly. It's not exactly going great because I'm eating crap food around that time. That's what I'm saying. There was a lot of carbs, a lot of meat, and halfway through my business, I hear, right on the door of the restroom, kung, 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 the record stopped! The record stopped! It is the cleaning lady thought she would take the moment that I was out of the studio. Oh, I'll go in there with my rags and feather duster, and I'll take care of the studio while the gentleman is out of the room. And I pinch my business off. Was not pretty. I run out. Pants practically dangling, you know, below my hips as I'm buckling up, run in there, try and figure out immediately what's going on. It's like, what is happening? And the only thing I can think of is that on the American Top 40 is on a turntable. There are two tiny little buttons for each turntable, a green and a red. Go and stop. And the only thing I can think of is that she was, you know, dusting or rubbing or whatever and hit the button. So I hit green and you hear on the radio, and that's it. And now, coming up next. So, which means a few minutes ago, you heard, and coming up next on a mirror. And cold sweat, because I'm sure I'm fired and hotline's going to ring, or, you know, Gary Winter's going to bust through the door and tell me to get lost. not a soul call. Nobody was listening.
Nobody's listening to Fewer Care.
But to this day, I've never forgotten that feeling of, and which is why I have the world's most stable bladder and bowels. I never go during my shifts ever anymore.
Connected to that.
And by the way, I'm sure you all enjoy hearing
that. Yeah, thanks. I'm never going to eat again.
I was full time at this point, and my weekend shift was Sunday morning. So again, depending on when the sun comes up, I had to sign on about 6:15.
When the sun comes up.
Well, I forgot to set my alarm on that Sunday morning. I woke up and it was 9:30.
Oh, worst feeling.
Okay, they're reacting because we all know how that feels.
Oh, yeah.
I get in my car. I wasn't even dressed. I'm dressing as I'm going. I'm whipping down. I pull in the parking lot. I unlock the door. We all had a key.
Sure.
I unlock the door. I go walking in. The phones are not ringing. I go in the control room, go over to the transmitter, turn it on.
And everything goes.
It does. It's pretty crazy.
The tubes come on.
So I just go and I put a record and start it. The rest of the morning, the phone never rang and nobody ever brought it up to me.
Now, had you had any sort of different work ethic, you would have gone, well, I guess I can sleep in until 9:30 from now on.
Let me ask you a question.
Oh,
you probably first experienced it. I don't know. I'll let you say when. But I'm guessing when in Birmingham, when things started to really heat up for you, like when you got back from New York, the Letterman thing or whatever. You have had fans like through the Mark and Brian days. So many, you know, I arrived in L.A. in 97, and your bumper stickers are everywhere and billboards and all this stuff. And knew you had rabid fans then. But then you go off the air and you're doing your podcast, and I hear about you coming back. And I start checking out your podcast a couple of times, and I see these crazy animals that have followed you. They would follow you to Siberia, and you know anything that you would you know, slap your name on, you and Linda's name on, they would buy. Mm-hmm. They'd buy gold-plated chewing gum if it said Mark and Linda on it. They all love you. I've seen you out at events where if they could just touch the hem of your garment, and in turn, you berate them. Mm-hmm. And tell them off. You don't remember and you threw it out. And they still will follow you everywhere to the point that, yes, I am hoping for a job, but lately I've been filling in. They asked me to go out and Sky Daniels to fill in last month at 88.5 over here at Cal State Northridge. And they were going to send me on for 3 weeks. So many of those people that found me through the sound, and some that knew me from the sound from before and whatever, but these people that were fans of yours who kept following along, Gina and I, they were calling the station and making donations and saying, well, we'll make a donation, but you got to hire him. Mm. And it's so much better, you know, having him there and continuing to support me and supporting this podcast and so forth. And so, you know, we got the halo effect of going in your orbit for a year or two. What is that? What is the phenomenon? Do you ever stop and look at, because it's not just celebrity. It's not just that everybody knows who you are. It's that they have somehow made you a part of their family.
Well, what happens is this. You have these people that are, and they live in Los Angeles, and they're sitting in their car for, what, hour and a half, 2 hours every day.
Sure.
It's one of the few times that they're alone in their day, and they invite you into their world. And because of the kind of show that we did, or I did, I would talk all about my life, my kids, funny things that happened with my wife, a vacation, whatever the story was, I was open. Brian was not. He didn't like sharing any private stuff, but I was. And so these people begin in their mind a friendship with you, because I would meet them at appearances, and they knew all about the fact that Matt shit in his bed 2 weeks ago, and but you've never met this person in your life. And what happens is you become ingrained in their life. And, you know, it initially at the beginning, I just wanted to get on the radio and tell jokes. I didn't go any further than that. But it wasn't until I was told this, and I've been told this so many times since. A guy will come up and he'll go, you know, last year I lost my mom, my dad, my wife, whatever the case may be. And it was a very, very bleak, depressing time. The only smile I got was listening to you. And I think that's probably the largest compliment that I've ever received in my life. I was, by virtue of getting on the air and cussing people out and telling really bad jokes, I'm helping somebody go through a tough time in their life. And so I think that's the point. These people that now support Mark and Linda and Daddy Versus Daughters, they feel connected. They, like, if I'm in a movie, they don't know what I look like. But if I laugh, they turn around. Yeah. Are you Mark?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's that. They begin a friendship with you, and you are part of their life, and it's that important to them.
When we go down to the OC Fair, it's... Yeah. 5 months after Mark in the Morning goes on. And you had said, wear something nice, because I think some people are going to come out to say hello to you. From what you had remembered from Mark and Brian days. We go out there, and I'm thinking, you know, there might be a couple hundred people showing up for this. This would be a lot of fun. There are 2,500 people mm-hmm. waiting to take a picture with this monkey yeah. right here.
And this is in the hot July sun.
Blazing hot.
You know, I think... I'm sorry.
And I was going to say, what was I going to say? I don't remember. No. Go ahead.
I think it goes back to what you said about the best compliment you ever got, which was...
People... I don't sound like a DJ. They want to spend time with me afterwards.
And I think we came out, especially Mark and I, came out of an era where the disc jockeys we were listening to were bigger than life. Mm-hmm. They were big personalities. They were celebrities in the, probably for you too. They were celebrities in these small towns. And I know since that time, I think what we've become, and I think you do this on the air now, especially, and clearly Mark did it, and I hope that I've done it too, is that they are forming an attachment to somebody who's more real mm-hmm. than a big celebrity. Now, you still are show business, mm-hmm. and you're still somebody that is, you know, to an extent, we all are to certain levels, him mostly, celebrities, but somebody that, for better or worse, people feel like they can approach you, they know about you, yes, they want to hang out with you. And that's a big difference.
That was what I was going to say. Yeah. That was the weird thing. I remember, you know, making an adjustment in my mind, because, you know, I've gone out to the Greek Theater, and you look out, there's 20,000 people, and that stuff doesn't really bother me that much. It's the more, hey, we're here for you kind of stuff. And that was concentrated right there. And I made the adjustment of it because it was something a little different than what I had experienced in the past. But I had been talking about my family on the radio, mm-hmm. about Laura mm-hmm. and about Silas mm-hmm. and little Viv. And I was, you know, instantly made the adjustment. And I'm like, okay, I see how things are going to be now. They showed up mm-hmm. and people are coming up to them who had never seen them before. Right. Or they had never seen, but they recognized them from pictures or whatever, and they said, "Hey, you're Silas," and you're, you know, they, and Silas was wigged out, man, because he's a shy kid to begin with, and these people, strangers who knew something about his life, is like, I don't know what's going on. They had to get out of that area.
Well, I can tell you that it's by design. There's nothing as an on-air personality. There's nothing more important than you can do than when you share your idiot self and your stupid life on the air, because it lets the audience know you're a regular guy.
And you have such a deep well from which to draw.
It's so true.
Well, one great thing about you, Mark, is, I mean, you talk about Brian not wanting to reveal his personal life, but if Brian did a voice, Brian did a character or whatever, you were the audience reacting to that. Mm-hmm. You laughing mm-hmm. is us laughing at that. And that's very ingratiating.
Everything I did on Mark in the Morning, everything I did, Larry, was aimed for his ears.
Yeah, to because make, you to figure make him laugh. If he's going to enjoy it, then somebody out there is bound to, though he's a fucking easy laugh, I got to say.
I would do a thing where with Mark and Brian, and I also did it at Mark in the Morning, the producer would send me the script for the next day,
right.
And I would highlight my lines, but I didn't read them. So when I was on the air, all the jokes were fresh. And so I would just read my lines. So I was available as a real audience member to get super tickled.
Great. Oh, yeah. Great. Okay.
And we were never given the scripts before, like right before.
Yeah.
Just right before it happens, and we were all doing it, you know, without knowing what was coming up. And
well, that's because Danny sucked. He had had him the night before.
Good that's God. Just bad producing. Yeah. Yeah. If you think about when Mark and Brian started in this town, what was big then? And that was Rick Dees. That was Yuck 'em Up, Set 'em Up punchline. as high energy, goofy, stupid. You say tell dumb jokes on the air. There's a big difference between what he was doing, which was very popular for a while. But after a while, it was just like, can we just hear a human being talk to us for a little bit?
So that reminds me, I was sitting, we'd been hired at KLOS. And our house is packed up, boxes are everywhere, the truck is coming tomorrow. And I'm on the phone doing an interview with the Los Angeles Times. And it's some grunt reporter who's pissed off because he has to talk to this guy.
Hillbilly from Birmingham.
Yeah, he was just asking
Hillbilly
me these,
disc jockey.
Just this, you know, questions 101 about whatever it was. And then I could figuratively hear him put his pen down.
He just disengaged.
Yeah, and he said, you realize Rick Dees is here, don't you?
Oh.
And I said, yeah. Now, you know, Rick was number one, and Larry's right. Rick would do the setup, punchline, hit the song. Setup, punchline, hit the commercials. But he was Rick Dees, and he was number one. We came out here privately. I hoped that we could get enough ratings to stay,
right.
just to right. remain. Because the horror stories that I had heard about Major Market is that if you, like the book comes out every 3 months, and if you don't have great ratings, you're gone. We beat Rick and were number one within a year. Because the difference, and you hit the point, the difference between what Rick did and what we did was a complete 180. Plus, Rick was in his eighth year. So people were already starting to tire.
Starting to tire.
So here, what if somebody said, tell me exactly what Mark and Brian was, I would tell you this story. I would have in my hand a little clip from the newspaper, last week's TV Top 10. Now, most shows, you're just going to read the top 10. That's 30 seconds of content, and then you're looking for something else. Mark and Brian would open up our vast album collection of really stupid music.
Mm-hmm.
And on the air, we would put the needle on a track and listen to it. No, that's not right. Give me the blue one. And we would do an hour of that hilarity on the air until we settled on the music track, Termites in My Woody, to read the TV Top 10. And that's what we were. That's what we were. And thanks to Letterman, you know, like at Christmas, other morning shows were giving away Christmas trees for you and your family. We were throwing them off onto La Cienega Boulevard from the roof. And that's just what we were. And by the way, let me offer you one of the greatest things you're ever going to see. All of you, listen. I want you to go, when you've got some spare time, I want you to go to YouTube, and I want you to type in Jay Leno as a guest on the David Letterman program telling the, who was the, can't think, I got a block, it was a television series, hi-ho, Lone Ranger, Jay Leno on the David Letterman program,
Jay Thomas.
Tells the listen, Jay Thomas is a masterful storyteller.
Oh God, and the story of him meeting
a radio story. Yeah.
I mean, we've been sitting here telling this is the king.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
And obviously, I got emotional on Mark in the Morning when Dave retired, because Dave showed me that it's okay to be super stupid.
Oh yeah.
Like he loved Jay. And every Christmas they had on the late night show a Christmas tree with a giant sausage ball on the top.
Right.
And he would have Jay Thomas come and they would each take turns throwing footballs at the sausage until somebody knocked it off. There's no point to it.
Not at all.
And it was riveting. And my favorite, this was early on. Dave was the first, you know, like Johnny Carson would sit at the desk and he would not move. Dave would get up from his desk.
Take off his jacket, roll up his sleeves.
And a camera would follow him into the back of the theater. He had Joan Collins on that night. As he's walking, he bangs on a aluminum trash can. 5 minutes, Miss Collins. She left. She vacated. And that's the king. That is David Letterman, the king.
Yeah, he made it okay to expose the warts. I mean, I've been reading a lot about Dave. There's a really good book out right now, and I related the same thing because his humor spoke to me, too.
Oh,
it was just like, there's the guy I've been waiting for. And it was having a respect for the form while also showing everything behind the scenes about it, too.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the thing about radio, is that I took it very seriously and didn't take it seriously at all.
Well, he was from Indianapolis, and I had seen him.
Are you about to end the show?
In a little while. In a minute.
Does that close it?
What, this guitar?
Yeah,
I'm just going to hold it for a second.
All right, well, I've got...
I'm not going to, but take your time.
Yeah. Well,
he suddenly sees structure, so his ears perked up.
Well, the reason I was asking that is because I wanted to tell a story. This story is real quick, and it's also 100% true. And I don't think anybody's going to enjoy this more than Andy.
All right, can't wait.
My wife and I live 20 minutes north of Charlotte in Lake Norman, North Carolina, on the lake.
It's lovely.
Andrew has been.
Bucolic.
And so the big grocery store for us is Harris Teeter's. It's right like 2 miles from our house.
Yeah.
Huge. As opposed to here, we have wide lanes where you can, you know, you can't get a grocery shopping cart down here.
That's because all of the people are morbidly obese and are on those scooters. And you need
maybe you're right.
Two lanes going both ways.
Yeah. All right. Yep. So, Harris Teeter, 100% true. Every Thursday, my wife makes me go to Harris Teeter's with her so that she can get the senior discount of 5% if I'm present. That's what my relationship has come to. I got to go and be the token old guy so that bitch can get 5% off the grocery tab.
So if you're wondering, what's Mark up to now? I think we've answered the question.
By the way, the very first time that I was near radio, I was 10, and Christopher J. Ballou, this was in the days when jocks had three names.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
No more the case. Christopher J. Ballou was going to make appearance at Dipper Dan's, which was walkable from my house.
What is Dipper Dan's? Ice cream?
Ice cream, Sundays. Okay. And like I could go.
I'm glad.
Well, my father.
It's a play on Dapper Dan.
My father.
Oh, I get it.
You get it?
My father was the cheapest son of a bitch that lived. And so I wanted to get a Sunday, 37 cents. I would spend the entire day walking around picking up Coke bottles, cash them in, 37 cents, Dipper Dan's. So fucking good. It was actually 35, but I paid 2 extra cents for more nuts. All right.
The fact that you remember it so detailed shows how important that was to you.
No, I'm telling you, this was heaven for a 10-year-old kid. All right. So Christopher J. Ballou is going to make an appearance at Dipper Dan's. And this was in the day they actually did this. They would bring a huge turntable setup, and they would jock from the location.
Oh, right. Like WKRP in Cincinnati.
Oh, yeah.
They'd bring the ones and twos.
So I was so excited. It was a Saturday afternoon. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't wait. 2 o'clock comes. I go, and there's Christopher J. Ballou. There's that huge turntable thing, and he is broadcasting live. He's got the needle on the record, and I approach. Christopher J. Ballou, my idol, turns, looks at me, and says, Don't bump the needle, kid. I was hooked from that moment.
And there's the title of
The title of the episode. <Right there. laughs> Oh, God, that's good.
Mark, this has been a pleasure, man.
Well, listen, thank you, Larry, and an honor to get to meet you, and because you work at my favorite radio station.
Well, I've been a fan. I've been a listener. I've been a competitor. I've been incredibly jealous. I am a predecessor of yours on the sound. Mm-hmm.
We fired him for you.
Yeah. No. They
fired
him
for Uncle Joe. There you go.
I may have lasted a little longer than you, mm-hmm. like maybe two-thirds mm-hmm. longer than you, mm-hmm. but it paid off for you in getting two-thirds times the salary that I made. So I hope that makes you feel better. But what an honor, man. It's great to meet you.
Are you guys going to kiss? God.
Good. You want us to?
Well, I will tell you, Andy, we were doing the Mark in the Morning together, and Andy, his Colts were coming into town to play the Panthers, mm-hmm. so he flew in, which, by the way, I made fun of this hippie because he cooks his own coffee beans, and then he grinds them up and percolates it, and I made fun. So Andy comes, he had shipped a package from Amazon with the grinder and the press and all that shit, and he made this hippie coffee. It was the greatest shit I have ever. I was shitting within one scent of smelling that. It is. I made no more fun. That was worth all the trouble.
I just drink it on the toilet now. Yeah. to save moving around.
Well, if there's anything that we know Andy Chandler can make you do.
Shit.
Yeah.
Mark, great time. Hanging out with you again.
That's a terrible way to end this episode.
I think it's a perfect way.
Okay.
A perfect way to end. Where can people find your stuff? It's still on the markandlinda.com?
Yeah, the easiest way to do it, because there's two. There's the Mark and Linda podcast. That's on Fridays. Daddy versus Daughters is on Wednesdays. If you want to get crazy, you can go to the website and stream it, listen live, and get in the chat room with these other idiots that listen. So the easiest thing is to go to mnlstudios.com, the letter MAND, the letter L, studios.com. They're all there.
And now... a character actor, this guy. You're taking periodically roles. You're entertaining scripts that have been sent your way.
Well, what happened, as I was climbing the ladder of radio, each time I'd get to a town, I'd find the local theater, and I'd audition for a play, and I'd get a little something, and I'd do it. And then I get to L.A., and I'm like, well, first of all, this was after the craziness. This was early to mid-90s. I started taking real acting classes, real hardcore acting classes. And I had wished at a time that I wasn't on the radio because I wanted to go and try my hand.
You know, he was Reba's boyfriend on Reba McIntyre's.
Reba,
on that show. Yeah.
I know he and Brian were also in a Brady Bunch TV movie.
Oh, God.
I followed their career, Andy. I know what they've done. I know what he's done. I know what he is.
All right, so I want to come back to the Brady thing, but I want to finish this. So my radio career comes to an end. And I was processing what happened because everything I'd built myself up to be was no longer needed. But then it hit me, well, wait, dude, you've got all that acting that you would like to have done. Now you have nothing to stop you.
Right.
A casting buddy of mine called an agent in Atlanta. Atlanta is the number one shooting hub in the world. And she took me because we sent two scenes from a movie I made in Cleveland, and she took me. So now everything is self-tape. You no longer go into the audition. You videotape yourself.
Does Linda read with you?
Yes.
Awesome.
She does my makeup. She puts the camera, and she is the whole package.
It's awesome.
And I've started booking stuff. I was on Black Lightning as Randy, a Trump-loving white supremacist, where I said things to a black man I would never whisper.
Wow.
I would never whisper it. And then I just got back from a television show on Fox called Star with Queen Latifah. I had two scenes with her.
Awesome.
So I'm doing that. And, you know, I'm not interested in doing a show where I'm the star and I'm on a soundstage 15 hours a day. Not interested.
Right.
But these little one-day, two-day gigs in Atlanta, perfect for me.
Yeah.
Because, look, the great thing about and I mentioned earlier, I miss doing the show. I don't miss the 10-hour grind. The great thing about my life right now is I can sit down, enjoy a cigar, watch a little Andy Griffith. A little bit of that. Yeah, I'm that guy.
Still?
TV Land.
How many times have you seen that damn show?
Linda sits with me in the afternoon. I recite the lines along with the character. I've seen him so many times. But so a little bit of that is relaxing. A lot of that is boredom. I have to fight the boredom.
Yeah.
All right. So I'll do this one story. True. Actually happened. So the kids, they're young. So they want to get their sleeping bags. It's December. They want to get their sleeping bags, sleep on our floor, and they want to watch A Very Brady Christmas, which is one of the worst pieces of shit. We played Concerned Onlookers. Yes. Mr. Brady had gotten caught in a cave collapse.
Yeah, this was a series of Concerned Onlookers. Yes. Onlooker
rules. What a great name. What? For a podcast.
Concerned Onlooker.
Concerned Onlookers.
This was a regular bit I heard them do, and it's a great, I mean, they basically just shilled themselves out as background.
Right.
They never asked for leading roles. Featured, they never asked for speaking roles.
Featured by, our rule was, you have to be able to see our faces.
But and, no lines, right?
No, never any lines. Yeah.
And how many times did you end up doing this?
Oh, God.
A bunch.
We did like 40. We got stink eyes.
It's such a great idea.
If I go and look at IMDb, are there 40 movies where you're listed as Concerned Onlooker?
Yeah.
Well, they had different names.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, the one that was the most memorable is we were on Cheers, and Cheers was number one.
Right.
So they put us sitting at the bar.
Really?
Yeah.
The looks we got from the regular extras, because you had to be at the highest arc of extra to sit at the bar. They fucking hated us. The stares we got, steam coming off of them because we were sitting at the bar.
Interlopers.
Yeah. Now, where was I going with
a
that?
A very Brady.
Okay. All right. So the kids, they want to get their sleeping bags and watch a very, and I don't, I can't, I'm not, it's so bad. I can't. All right. So Linda, so we do, I go get the VHS and we put it in, and Linda's here and the kids are all around. One by one, they go to sleep. And I am left the only one watching that fucking pile of shit. Merry Christmas.
Now there's your out. All right.
Larry_Morgan, Twitter. Andy_Chanley at Twitter. God, it's been a long time since I've been in your presence and touted my Twitter.
And I don't do it. So don't try to find me.
Linda will. Linda's going to answer it if anybody does. Good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you.
Come back anytime.
I love you. I told you that when they took you from me and put you in the afternoon, I sat there and cried with you.
Yeah, I really didn't want to go and had the best radio time of my life in those, what is it, 11 months, 10 months that we had together. That was golden fun. And whenever I'm feeling down, I go back and listen to one of those stupid songs, and you howling in the background at it. It was the water that raised all boats.
And by the way, you were talking I'm rude to people. I cuss them out.
Oh, yeah.
I get minimum 2 requests a week.
People to chew out?
Yeah. Like Bob is going to turn 40 and they want to surprise him with a tape from me. And they say, rip him up good. So I do that.
You know what? It's that you're working with someone, or you're friends with someone, and they ridicule you like that in fun and jest.
Right.
When they stop doing that is when you know that you've shit the bed, that the friendship is over. It's like a hickey from Kinnicky. It's like getting Don Rickles insulting you.
Is that why you're so mean to me? Because you actually love me?
Yeah, we'll go with that.
Okay. Would you like to sing along with us at the end here?
No, I don't know the words.
I'll teach you the words.
No, trust me.
When the people you don't like,
I'm not singing.
Mark, sing along.
No.
When the people that you know don't like you, and your treasured friendships end.
This is horseshit. You know that.
Tune into this
horseshit.
We're your artificial friends.
Love you, buddy.
Love you, too.
Tolerate you, Andy.
Oh, heavens.
That was great.
That was fun. I mean, that was.